See my screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, in the next couple of 20 minutes, I want to give you a brief introduction about linguistic speech tracking by the brain. And I will start with a very general introduction to even just neural speech tracking. I know there are a lot of experts in the audience, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. So whenever you have an issue with hearing, the audiologist, which will test how much speech you can understand, can rely on an extensive test battery, which holds, for example, pure tone audiometry or sentence recall tests. And these tests, they have some clear disadvantages. Of course, these pure tone audiometries, they work with tones, and tones you cannot understand. And these sentence recall tests, they actually work with really standardized and controlled sentences, which is nothing like real listening environments. Additionally, if you fail on these tests or cannot perform these tests, then the outcome does not allow you to pinpoint the origin of the deficit. Is it situated more peripherally, and can the patient be helped with a hearing aid, or is it situated more cortically, where maybe language treatment is a better option? Additionally, there are also, another drawback of these tests is that they are not inclusive. Not everyone can perform these tasks. You need to have attention, and you need to be able to give feedback. But sometimes this is not possible. Think about working with very young children, or patients with coma, for example. So that's why our research group and many others try to go towards a more objective way of testing speech understanding, meaning that we look at brain signals to see or to try and see whether or not someone understands speech. And to do so, we rely on the phenomenon of neural checking. So very quickly, I know you've heard this yesterday. But whenever you listen to speech and you would meanwhile record brain signals, then you can actually trace certain characteristics of the speech back in the brain signals. And previous studies showed that using specific features of the speech, such as acoustics, they can really give you insight in how much speech you can understand. So if neural tracking to the acoustic feature of the speech is higher, the speech is better understood. But then comes the issue, does neural tracking to acoustics means speech understanding? Well, that's not necessarily the case, because we also observe like significant acoustic neural tracking whenever you listen to music, or whenever you listen to the ignored speaker in a cocktail paradigm. So you cannot say that if you have acoustic tracking, that there is a successful speech understanding. It might be that acoustic speech tracking is necessary in order to understand speech, but it's not a causality. So before we delve into the linguistic tracking stuff that I'm really eager to talk about, I want to first take a step back and go very conceptually about the methods that we use, and how this method actually works. So basically, we have a participant coming to our lab, and we make them listen to stories or podcasts. And then in the first step, we estimate a brain model. So we extract some speech representations. Think about the envelope, an acoustic speech representation here shown in the pinkish line. This can also be sublexical features. So sublexical features denote the onset of a word or a phoneme, and those are indicated by the pulses. So whenever, for example, here, whenever you have a phoneme, there's a pulse, and these pulses are always of the same height. And then you have the linguistic features. So basically, these are also features with a lot of pulses, but this time the amplitude changes depending on how much information the phoneme carries, but more details on those linguistic features later. So whenever you have extracted these speech representations, you have, of course, also the recorded brain responses. And then in the next step, you basically link those speech features with the recorded brain signals. And that's to obtain this temporal response function. In a second step, you actually have this estimated brain model. You will use this TRF, this temporal response function, in order to extract a measure of neural tracking. So first, again, you extract the speech features, and then you do a convolution with the temporal response function. A convolution is basically a multiplication over time. Just as a quick recap, so we have a feature here, we have a TRF. This multiplication over time or convolution works as follows. So whenever there's an impulse, you see the waveform of the temporal response function. Now, whenever the signals become more complex, you can predict more complex signals. For example, here you have two impulses next to each other. So the two TRFs are very close to each other. So the outcome of the multiplication over time or this convolution will be a summation of the two signals. On the other hand, these waveforms can also be out of phase. So there is like a cancellation of this wave here. Now, if you also vary the impulse's height or amplitude, then you can also, this also has an effect on your predicted signal. So using this multiplication over time, we have actually our speech feature that we extracted. We have the temporal response function, which tells you how the brain responds to the speech feature. Using this multiplication over time, we're basically giving or predicting a brain response evoked by the speech. We not only have the predicted brain signal, but also the actual brain signal, and that allows us to calculate a prediction accuracy, which is a measure of neural tracking. It's basically a correlation between each channel of the predicted signal with the actual recorded signal. I hope this very brief introduction was brief enough for the experts, but introductionary enough for all the beginners or for people who are unfamiliar with this method. The takeaway is you have two important outcomes. You have this temporal response function, which tells you how the brain responds to the speech features, and you have this prediction accuracy, which tells you how well the brain tracks the speech. It's the measure of neural tracking. And this you have for every, or both measures you have for every sensor that you used. So using this approach, I try to answer a couple of questions, and I will cover these three questions during the talk. So the first question is, which speech feature should we actually use whenever you want to investigate linguistic processing by the brain? And then the second and also the third is whether the speech features really reflect speech understanding, because we tested this via two different paradigms, and I would like to go into them both. So let's start with this first question. For this, we tested 29 young normal hearing participants who listened to a really long story presented in silence. At the beginning of my PhD, the first studies were published using linguistic speech features. So as a starting point, we made like a scheme of all the speech features that we were aware of that used linguistic speech features or other features. And we wanted to test whether these linguistics speech features at different levels. So you have at the phoneme level, so which characterizes the information at the level of a phoneme, at a word, or even at the level of the context. Whether these linguistic speech features actually explains more variance in the EEG signal, in the neural signal, on top of acoustical and suplexical features. Now, why is this important? If you look at speech features, they're all derived from exactly the same signal. And this causes that these speech features are highly correlated. So whenever you have a burst of acoustic energy, you know that the envelope is going to be like a high waveform, which symbolizes this burst. But at the beginning of this burst, there is a phoneme onset and also an impulse of how much information this phoneme carries. So if you would only test a linguistic feature, it is still highly correlated with the response to, for example, the envelope or purely the acoustics of the signal. So to make sure that we estimated linguistic tracking in a way that it's not biased by acoustic responses, we used a specific framework. I will call it the subtraction approach. So basically, we calculated two types of models. We a complete model. This complete model contains acoustic speech features, syplexical speech features, so the phoneme and word onsets, as well as these linguistic speech features. And then we subtracted the baseline model, which actually included all control variables. So these acoustic features and these syplexical features. And by taking the difference, we could investigate the added value of these linguistic features. So how much does a model improve in predicting the neural response whenever we add these linguistic features on top of the acoustics and syplexical features? This way, although it's not the perfect approach, of course, this way we tried to minimize the bias towards acoustic responses. But you see that the responses to linguistic speech features are really, really, really small. So that's also very, very challenging. But using this framework, we applied it on all the existing linguistic features or features that were already discussed in literature. And then we observed that not all of them survived this approach. So we observed these phoneme linguistic features, so phoneme surprisal and chord entropy, and these linguistic features at word level, so word surprisal and word frequency, those were significant. So for the rest of my talk, or we focused, or the rest of the studies that we did, we focused on those four linguistic features. But for this talk, I will only focus on word surprisal because it's a very intuitive feature. If you want to know more details about the other features, that's content for the workshop. So basically, word surprisal is how predictable or surprising a word is given the previous words. So for example, here this sentence, even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the, it's not surprising, you're going to expect light. So the surprisal value of light is rather low. If it would be to turn up the music, that would be surprising because it changes the concept of, or the context of the sentence that you had in mind. So these previous results we obtained by looking at prediction accuracies. So by looking at whether the linguistic features improve the prediction accuracy, so the measure of neural tracking. But we also had this other important outcome of the model. So the temporal response function, which tells you how the brain responds. And for word surprisal, it looked like this. So you have a clear negativity around 400 milliseconds, which is really prominent for these central channels here. And it's strikingly, so this is very similar to the N400 paradigms. Even in this case, it's using continuous speech and not carefully created controlled sentences. So in this first study, we identified which speech features we should use. The second question was, well, these speech features, they characterize some linguistic information, but do they really represent speech understanding? So to answer that, we manipulated the amount of speech understanding by speeding up or manipulating the speech rate. And we did this in 18 young normal hearing participants. And in total, we had around six speech rates, and each speech fragment was around 10 minutes. So to give you an example, I hope, wait, I am quickly going to check whether my sound is shared as well. Okay. I hope you can still see my screen and hope you can hear this example.
Mary, ik wil je graag mee uit eten nemen.
So, I'm Dutch speaking, so this is really slow speech. For some of you, it might be intelligible, but for our participants, it was understandable. So this was a slow condition, this was a fast condition. It's very difficult to understand. No participants actually reported that it was well intelligible. So what happens with linguistic tracking? What happens with this added value of these linguistic speech features? So the red dots here indicate the significant channels, or the channels which drive the topography to be significantly different from zero. And in the slow and normal condition, you see in these conditions that you see these red channels, meaning that the linguistic features do have an added value, but as it becomes faster and faster, less red circles, so this added value of linguistic features, it disappears. Then again, you can also look at the temporal response function, at how the brain responds. And then you see this. So although it's super noisy, because this time we only have 10 minutes of data, well, previously we had 45 minutes of data, but you see in the yellowish tones, we see a significant negativity, which is only present for the slower speech rates, which were intelligible by the listeners. Also, this characteristic topography, it fades away the faster the speech becomes. So this gives us a first insight, like, okay, maybe linguistic speech tracking really gives an indication of speech understanding. But there's a big but, because this paradigm, it used artificial speech, so we artificially sped up the speech. So what actually happens with natural speech? So in this case, we did a new experiment with 19 young normal hearing participants, which listened to different fragments, Dutch, Frisian, and a scrambled word list, and then we assessed the effect on linguistic neural tracking. To give you again an example, so for Dutch listeners, this will be intelligible.
Vandaag gaan we het hebben over Jack the Ripper.
Then the Frisian story.
Zowel Maddie die benne wordt op tol vermaaien twatuzen treien.
So the interesting about Dutch and Frisian. So the Frisian is spoken in the upper north of the Netherlands, and it follows a very similar grammatical structure as Dutch. It's nearly a one-on-one mapping, so that's why we chose Frisian. But the participants reported that they had around 50% of intelligibility. But this is, of course, subjectively rated. And then a last example is the word list.
Blijven mij in is hun is en Nadine.
So all these speech fragments are spoken by the same speaker, and they are also spoken in a very natural way, aiming to preserve the normal prosody. So we can actually again plot the same results. So again, we see added value of these linguistic speech features. So now we had only 7 minutes, and we only observe these significant channels for the Dutch story, but not for the Frisian nor the word list condition. Then in looking at the TRFs, we also see only this prominent negativity around 400 milliseconds for the Dutch story, but not for the Frisian or the wordless condition. And again, this characteristic topography, it disappears whenever it becomes not intelligible. So this again gives us some insight that maybe linguistic tracking might be a good indicator on whether or not speech was understood. But there are some clear pro and cons. So because it's an indicator, like, or my results show that it might be an indicator for speech understanding, so it can really pinpoint understanding and not just hearing. The disadvantage is that you require lots of data. You need quite some participants, because currently we can only look at it on a population level. And also per participants, there's a minimum of 10 minutes, but I would give you, like, ideally the more data, the better, because it's such a small effect, which makes it really, really challenging. But we're currently working on an approach to make this more robust, but it's challenging. So in my workshop, my goal is to really make you able to craft your own speech features, to make these phoneme segmentations, do this language model so you can create your own word surprisal stuff, and you can apply this for your experiments so that we can all accelerate science together. So yeah, that's it. That's it. I'm happy to take any questions.
Cool talk. Thanks, Marlies. We have a question in the chat, but the asker is going to ask her themselves.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
My question was, when you were looking at the difference between the fast and the slow speech, did you also look at the differences in just the acoustic model to see if changing this changed the tracking of the envelope or the other acoustic features that you used?
Yes, good point. Yes, we did look at the acoustics as well. Maybe I can annotate. I'm trying to, so I'm going to, hopefully you can see my drawing. Can you see it?
Yep.
Okay.
It's a great drawing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So what do we actually, what my point, I cannot proceed with this drawing. Not technical enough, I guess, to manage Zoom. But anyway, what we saw is that with speech rate, so this is increasing speech rate, and this is neural tracking. So in the beginning, we see an increase with higher speech rates. And if I'm not mistaken, this effect was also seen yesterday. So with higher speech rates in the beginning, there's higher acoustic tracking, which I think makes sense. And because there are just more acoustic boundaries to track and to respond to, so your neural tracking improves. But then at the end, where it's super, super fast, we see again a decrease. And this puzzled us a bit, so we went digging in literature. And then we could form some hypotheses, but this is purely speculations, that this might be due to motor cortex involvement. So whenever you listen to speech, your motor cortex is active and it syncs a bit to how your lips would move. But when the speech is so, so fast, you don't have this lip image and you cannot mimic on how your muscles would be able to pronounce this. Hence, your acoustic tracking would be slightly lower when it's super, super fast, when it's unnatural to be pronounced. So I hope that's clear and it answered your question.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much. And it was a great talk. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Ed, if you want to ask that, you're more than welcome to. I can unmute you, or I can ask it. If you raise your hand, you can ask, but if you don't raise your hand, I'll just read it. There you go.
Hi, Marlies. That was a really nice talk. I don't know. I think I've asked you this question before, just about kind of linking across the different levels of processing where, you know, some of the time if you're calculating things like phoneme surprisal and so on, it's kind of word-specific phoneme surprisal, whereas obviously the phoneme, the surprisal of a given phoneme will be affected by how likely that particular word was to come up and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know if you'd thought about that any further or have anything to say on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed, there are like lots of ways that linguistic features can be improved. We currently calculate phoneme surprisal for a word independent of the previous words. So that's indeed a drawback of the current approach. But there are papers, a fairly recent one by Brodbeck, where he really tried to see at which level this phoneme surprisal should be modeled, whether how much context windows and whether it's more top down or a bottom up effect. I feel using linguistic features that it's a bit like our brain is not exactly the same as a language model. So there will be ways to improve this, but I think it's very challenging to do it really in the right way, because even if you take further context into account, how will it affect, I don't know. I'm puzzled by this myself to craft an optimal linguistic feature. I think this is a good starting point, but because for example, for word surprisal, I've tried comparing different language models, n-grams, which are the most simple ones, which I usually use, RNNs, LSTMs, which are able to have like way more context than this simple n-gram model, using lots of participants and 45 minutes of data. I cannot find a significant difference between those three language models, although the complexity is really, really different. So my takeaways, like, this is a group, like linguistic features are a good proxy, but like, I don't think the brain is really a language model. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that's lots of interesting stuff there in that answer. Thank you.
I have a question if no one else has one. I know Tom is big on creation and patents, and I was wondering if your involvement or if the lab involvement in this sort of project sort of ends at like the basic science, or if you all are working on implementing this for audiologist or clinical practice, like to any degree, any level of degree.
Well, I'm not involved in any patents, so, and I'm also not really aware of all those things. So if you want to use this stuff, you can use this.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. Well, if there are no more, someone has a hand raised. Ola has a hand raised. Feel free to ask a question, Ola. Ola? Did you raise your hand, Ola? We can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yo.
Okay. So my question was, in the I think last experiment you showed like the contrast between word lists and the continuous story, that the word list doesn't show like an effect of word surprisal. Like, have you tried like actively modulating the surprisal of words in the word list? Like in the sense that, you know, if I have like a list where I say like house, cathedral, bridge, elephant, or something like that, like the word elephant would be surprising in that scenario. And maybe that would be like a way we could disentangle sort of narrative surprisal from this sort of simplistic word model, just word by word probability. Is that something you've looked into?
It's not something I've looked into, but it's very interesting. Because I think the N400-ish response that you will get using your like word lists, which are actually semantically related and then suddenly unrelated, those will yield a way bigger response than narratives. That's my gut feeling. Because those, like, you are really manipulating it in order for the participant to be surprised, while it is not really natural. Like, no one is going to say to you that he just ate a sandwich with elephant. So yeah.
I mean, I gave an extreme example now, of course, but I mean, you could use language models to like carefully sort of titrate the amount of surprisal in the word list so it kind of matches that of a natural story, and then compare. Would you think the two responses would be similar, or there would still be some difference between the two?
Okay. I made a wrong interpretation. No. I think then probably the effect might be similar, but it will be very, very tricky because you always need to be primed. And so if you're in word lists, like house, cathedral, those words will probably have like similar word probabilities or maybe like semantically they're in a very same category, and those artificial settings will be also very difficult to recreate in a naturalistic story condition, because in the naturalistic story condition we really have this grammatical structure with nouns and pronouns and verbs. It's interesting to think about, and maybe if you're really clever you can come up with a cool design, but I think it's worth to wrap your head about it, but I'm not 100% sure what the outcome will be, but it would be cool to check it out.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a pretty cool idea. I think there's a little bit of stuff to like think through that, but I think that's a great idea. Thanks, Marley, for that. Or with that, I think we'll thank Marley, virtually at least, and move on for the sake of time. I'm going to steal the screen back from you, Marley. So up next, we have our keynote from Micah Heilbronn. So Micah is a brand new professor, assistant professor. Let me get on to my slideshow there. It's brand new assistant professor of cognitive AI at the University of Amsterdam, and is interested in how brains and artificial systems understand language and make sense of the world. He was trained at the Donders Institute and the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics under the supervision of two highly regarded scientists, Florence DeLong and Peter Haggart, and wrote a provocatively titled thesis, at least I think, maybe not so much provocative, but interesting. I mean, which is here. I like the idea of the bi-directional window into things. So I wanted to put that up on the screen. Micah also published one of my lab's favorite, or at least Ed's lab's favorite papers last year. And not just because they analyzed some of our lab's data, which happens to be available on the CNSP website, But in this paper, he analyzed word level predictions from a large language model and showed multiple hierarchical predictions. So maybe getting at some of those questions that were asked in the end there, that were dissociated in neural activity, which we just thought was really exciting that he could pull that out of our data and some other data. So I'm really excited to introduce our early career keynote to be given by Micah Heilbronn. So join us in welcoming him.
All right, so if everything should be working, you should be able to see my slides now. Is that correct?
See your slides and hear you.
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, thanks for the very kind introduction and for the invitation, of course. It's an honor and it's a lot of fun to be here. It's also really nice and cool speaking just after Marlies, because our work is very similar in some ways, at least to some of what I will be presenting. But I'll be coming from a pretty different theoretical background, but the methods are in many aspects quite similar. So I guess that's also very nice and pedagogical for all the attendees. They can see very similar ways of working and drawing quite different conclusions or learning different aspects of the same types of analyses. All right. So today what I want to talk about is a sort of more high-level framework for studying the brain and how we can use both the types of naturalistic data analyses that we are discussing in these 2 days, and modern AI developments, and how we can combine them. So now I hope that my clicker will work. All right, cool. So the theoretical backdrop here is the idea of the predictive brain. And the predictive brain is this sort of very high level term for a family of models and theories, really, that all revolve around the idea that the brain, neural processing in the brain, relies on continuous prediction. And mechanistically, this is formalized in most detail in vision, in particular around mechanistic ideas like predictive coding. And here it's typically formalized as this bidirectional processing cascade, where the feed-forward component works something akin to a ConvNet in the sense that it extracts increasingly abstract features. And this is then complemented by a top-down component, which conveys predictions from a generative model. And so these predictions are constantly compared to what is coming in. And by making this comparison, the brain computes a prediction error, which is used both for inference at short timescales to try to make sense of what is out there, and at longer timescales to learn, to perform self-supervised learning. And importantly, this is postulated to be a canonical cortical computation, which is, I guess, a fancy way of saying that it's something really quite general and something fundamental and something that is found all over the brain. So this should be a fundamental principle that applies not just to vision, but also to hearing and to language and what have you. Now, there is quite some evidence that is in line with this idea. And that has made the framework pretty influential over the past years. So for instance, in the domain of visual perception, a very influential set of paradigms is, for instance, statistical learning. So participants would then be exposed over and over to one stimulus predicting another stimulus, such as here, a jukebox predicting a clock. And what is observed is that as participants are exposed to these regularities, so jukebox, clock, jukebox, clock, jukebox, clock, over and over, as one stimulus becomes predictable, so here the clock, you see that the brain responds differently, much more weakly than if it's unpredictable. And you see this in many domains. So for instance, in language, Marlies already referred to the N400. So when a sentence ends expectedly, so I drink my coffee with cream and sugar, the brain responds very differently and much more weakly than if the sentence ends unexpectedly, like I drink my coffee with cream and dog. Right. So time and again, in all these domains, what all these types of evidence seem to point to is this predictive brain idea, where the brain is seemingly constantly comparing what is coming in to its own expectations. Now, all this foundational work using, let's say, classical cogneuro methods is, of course, very important, and it has taught us a lot. And it's the reason that I got interested in the predictive brain in the first place. But there are some limitations of this sort of classical approach. And the first is generalization. So while we now know very well that the brain indeed starts predicting in these specific paradigms, like jukebox clock, what is not so clear is whether the findings in those jukebox clock scenarios would also generalize to perception more broadly. And this is actually very important for the predictive brain, because for the predictive brain, the idea is not that the brain can predict, but that it always does. Right, so does it also apply to a more naturalistic scenario, like when you're listening to music or you're watching movies, or perhaps you're just seeing complex images? And the second question is, what is meant by a prediction? Because this predictive brain theory is a very general theory. So according to the predictive brain, a prediction can be anything. So if you're predicting a clock, for instance, you might predict some high-level idea or some visual prototype, or perhaps even the very specific low-level features of that exact clock. Now, of course, neurally, these different options, these different scenarios would imply a very different neural mechanism. But it's often not so clear in these sort of classical methods what types of predictions are manipulated and therefore what is going on. Now, there are two recent sort of developments in neuroscience and AI machine learning that allow addressing both these issues. And the first is the rise of generative AI. So for a long time, this notion of a generative model that predictive brain theories talked about was quite elusive. And people could write down the equations and it was formulated in a Bayesian brain framework, but no one could actually implement the types of predictions that we thought the brain would be making. And this is now changing, since generative models are actually working. So for instance, in language, one sort of very striking example is GPT-4 and all other sort of more sophisticated generative models. So these are models that can predict stimuli and you can, and then they can generate text, for instance. It, the same is true for videos. So they predict video frames and they could generate a video. Now, the second development is sort of the rise of neural data science and open science more broadly. So we now have these large data sets of very high quality naturalistic images of naturalistic stimuli of, that is both sort of in the mouse or rodents, like invasive electrophysiology, and also the types of data sets we've been talking about today. So what I've been doing is sort of combining these two trends, and then I call it the generative AI framework for studying the predictive brain. So how does that work? So instead of, so you, the setup in general is quite simple. You start with a stimulus, often a naturalistic stimulus, so not a jukebox clock stimulus, but for instance, in language could be an audiobook or natural music or simply natural images. And these are simply shown to the brain and the brain activity is recorded. Now, at the same time, the same naturalistic images are analyzed with a neural network, and then specifically a generative model. So a model that can predict, for instance, the next word, or it can predict the next note in music. And then these predictions can be compared to the actual stimuli to compute the predictability. And then we perform a regression to test if indeed the brain response is different when this the stimulus is predictable versus unpredictable. And this regression can be depending on the situation. So if it's a time continuous naturalistic stimulus, you would need deconvolution approaches like implemented in the MTRF toolbox. It can also be a non-deconvolution if there's no temporal overlap. But the important aspect is that it's a multiple regression approach. So we can include all the baseline variables like Marlies already talked about, such as acoustics or envision, can be local contrast. And on top of that, we add the expectedness estimates to test if the brain responds differently to unexpectedness while controlling for low-level confidence. Now, this has two sort of main advantages. And the first is generalization, right? So we can move beyond the jukebox clock scenario and test if, even when you're simply watching a movie, if the brain responds differently when a stimulus is predictable. And the second, perhaps more interesting aspect, is that because we model the predictions instead of manipulating them, you can make the concept of prediction as precise as you want. So you can, for instance, compute the overall predictability of a word, but you can also separately model the predictability at different levels of abstraction, like the predictability of the meaning or the predictability of the exact sound. and so on. So here you're only limited by your own modeling skills and imagination, and you can make this concept of prediction arbitrarily precise. So you can have, as I like to call it, you can have an unlimited conceptual resolution. So if we're using really powerful and beautiful open data sets, we have very nice temporal resolution, very nice spatial resolution, and only limited by your own modeling, you can have very strong conceptual resolution. All right, so that's still very high level. Now, the first sort of study where I was approaching this framework and I worked it out in detail was a study for my PhD, which was on language. And here we analyzed people listening to audiobooks, and one of the data sets was actually the data set recorded by, I think, Giovanni, and it was graciously shared by the Lalore Lab. And another data set is an EEG, the MEG data set that we recorded ourselves at the Donders. And to model the predictions, we use GPT-2, which is this large generative model which can predict the upcoming word. Now, from GPT-2, what you get are the high-level predictabilities of words. So, for instance, this is one of the sentences from one of the audiobooks. It made the boy sad too. And then what you get from the model is a probability distribution over every potential next word. And what we came up with in this paper was a method to then disentangle this overall prediction into different levels of prediction. So, for instance, how did that work? You can see here that it made the boy start to think, to see, to know, to hear, to say, to be. If you analyze all these predictions, you see, even though GPT-2 is not exactly sure about the identity of the next word, all these are verbs. So it's pretty damn sure that the next word will be a verb. You can do the same for semantics and for speech sounds. So you can compute not just how predictable a word is overall, but also at what level. So syntactically, lexically, or phonologically. So the striking thing of this paper was that we found that the brain responds not just to word unexpectedness, but it responds differently to each type of unexpectedness. So here you can see the TRFs. And you see that, for instance, the syntactic predictability leads to a very early frontal effect, whereas semantic predictability results in a much later and spatially much more distributed effect. Whereas phonological or phoneme predictability leads to this early effect. And here I'm showing the TRFs, but we also did an analysis like Marlies described, where you look at if the model, if each of these variables explains unique cross-validated variants over and above the baseline variables. And so we found independent, dissociable, and sort of unique contributions of predictions at each level of abstraction. So given that it seems that when you simply listen to speech, the brain predicts at multiple levels of abstraction, the next question we asked was, how do different levels interact? And we already touched on this a bit during the Q&A with Marlies. But one way to look at that is to look at different ways of doing phoneme prediction. So normally how this works, phoneme predictions are sort of formalized by the idea of incremental word recognition. So as phonemes come in, the cohort of potential lexical candidates that are consistent with the phonemes so far shrinks until the word is incrementally recognized. And you can cast this as a process of probabilistic phoneme prediction by grouping each of the candidates' next words by their identifying next phoneme. So fact, family, fat would be false, for, fortunate would be all, figure, finish, fisherman would be etc. If you then attach a weight to each of these candidates, you can do the math and derive a probability distribution over phonemes for each phoneme. Now, there are two ways of assigning the weight. And one way is to use the simple, the lexical frequency or the unigram probability. So here you would take the probability of an overall word overall in English. So for instance, the word for is very frequent. So we would have a very high a priori likelihood. And the overall probability for the next phoneme is then highly biased by these high frequency words. Now, alternative possibility is that it's the weight is not determined by the overall word probability or word frequency, but by the contextual probability that we take from GPT-2. And here the distribution would be quite different, because if we look at this context, they say his father was a, The word for, even though it's very high frequency, is not very likely because it wouldn't be even grammatical. They say his father was a four. Whereas fisherman, even though overall it's a very unlikely word, in this context, it's very likely because this is from The Old Man and the Sea. I don't know if you've read it, but it's all about fishing and fishermen. So GPT-2 understood that and knew that it was indeed very likely. So the overall probability distribution looks very different. Now, importantly, while this frequency model is a single level model in the sense that it uses a short sequences of context, so short within word sequences of phonemes as a context plus a fixed prior, namely the overall probability of each word in the English language. The contextual model is hierarchical in the sense that you use not just short intra-word frequencies of prior phonemes, but the prediction is also based on the longer sequences of prior words. So it's hierarchical in this way, the concept of hierarchical graphical models in Bayesian inference. For instance, you use two levels of context. And so what we did is we compared the sort of cross-validated prediction performance of both models and compared it to the baseline model. And what we found both in the EEG and in the MEG participants that the models that include word phoneme unexpectedness work better than the baseline, but the models that include hierarchical unexpectedness work better still. And this is indeed very much in line with the sort of concurrent paper from Christian Brodbeck, where they actually found, they asked a different question, and they found that the single level and the hierarchical model seemed to work in parallel. So we did a very rough, is one better than the other analysis, and it seems that the brain indeed performs hierarchical computation, but it may also perform single level computation. So the story may be a bit more subtle there. But overall, what we found in language is that when people listen to natural language, the brain constantly predicts. It predicts at multiple levels of abstraction, and we find this very suggestive evidence that at least in the domain of phonemes, higher level context can inform lower level context, which is exactly what you would expect from this predictive brain idea. And with a master's student, we performed a similar study in music. So the setup was quite similar. We again did one MEG study at the Donders and graciously thankfully used the data set provided by Giovanni, which is EEG. And the setup was again similar. So people listened to MIDI, which is converted to audio. And then at the same time, we have a transformer very similar to GPT-2, which analyzes the MIDI. And then we ask if the brain responses to the musical notes, so not words, but here musical notes, are different as a function of the unexpectedness of the musical notes. And again, we found, as well as in the MEG, EEG, as in the MEG data, we find these characteristic TRFs, and we find that the brain response is indeed modulated by the unexpectedness of the tone. Also similar to what Giovanni and others found. The twist of this study was not the TRF itself, but was what type of information is used in the prediction. So here we use not just one neural network, but we use actually many neural networks, which each use a different amount of context. And what we found first is that the neural network that used the most context could predict the music best. And this is not surprising, but it was an important sanity check. So the more information we gave to the transformer, the better it became at predicting the next note. But when we did the same analysis for the delta, for the not the ability to predict the music, but the ability to predict the brain using the unexpectedness of the music, we found a very different curve. So here we found that the models that best predict the musical surprisal response was actually not the model that used the most context, but that used one of the fewest contexts. So a context window of maybe only 5 to 10 words. So this is a very short, just a few seconds, just one or two musical motifs. So contrary to language, what we found is that the musical surprise response actually seems to reflect very low level in the sense of short range acoustic predictions. And yeah, this study was, by the way, very much spearheaded by Pius, who is now starting a PhD, and I wanted to mention him specifically. All right. So in the last study I wanted to highlight, I want to take this idea to the visual domain. And here it's just the visual perception of naturalistic images. And here the situation is quite different, because when you simply see a natural scene, a complex image like this, there's no temporal prediction. However, one form of prediction that might be there and that is very important in sort of classical predictive coding theories is spatial prediction or pattern completion. Now, pattern completion is pretty easy to think about in very extreme cases, like a checkerboard, where if you perceive only a small part of the stimulus, you can perfectly pattern complete and predict the rest. But how can you probe this in more naturalistic images? Now, here we took an idea inspired by a paper from last year from Neuron, which is a very nice paper. And the key idea is that it relies on receptive fields. So just to make sure that everyone understands what I mean by that, the visual cortex is sensitive to only these small apertures, small parts of the visual world. And if you have a data set where you know the receptive field for each voxel or for each neuron, like in the Allen Institute visual coding data set of the mouse visual cortex, what you can do is that you can take out, you can mask out the receptive field from the perceived image, take a generative model that is trained for filling in, for inpainting, for reconstructing, to reconstruct and to predict the content of the receptive field, and then compare the predicted receptive field to the actual receptive field to compute the visual predictability. And then you regress that again on the brain response while taking into account low-level visual information like the visual contrast. Now, importantly, like before, you can compute not just the overall predictability, but you can compute this predictability at multiple levels of abstraction. So if you take your actual receptive field patch and your predicted receptive field patch, what you can do is extract a hierarchy of features. Here we did that with a convolutional neural network, but you could theoretically also use something else. And in CNN, the early layers extract simple patterns like edges and lines, whereas later layers extract things like textures and object parts, so more high level features. And if you do the comparison at each level, you can compute not just how unexpected or how unpredictable the visual information is overall, but also at what level of abstraction, like at the level of simple edges or textures or shapes, et cetera. And so just to make sure that you understand what's going on, the data set here is a data set of mice viewing the large full field images all for 250 milliseconds at the same time. And each image is repeated 50 times. In total, it's like 6,000 trials, and you have thousands of neurons. All right, so if we look at V1, the average response looks like this. It's the blue line. You see that when a natural image comes online, the firing rate starts to peak. And so the red line here is sort of analogous to the TRF, although we didn't use a TRF method, but just linear regression. But it's the effect of the average response to a natural image plus one SD of the unpredictability. And just for comparison, the gray line here is the effect of the average response plus that of local contrast in the preferred spatial orientation and spatial frequency. So what is quite interesting is you can see that unpredictability modulates the response, but it modulates the response only later in line with the more recurrent process, whereas a low-level contrast modulates the immediate feed-forward sweep, and it has also a stronger effect. Now, if you do that for each convolutional layer, so for each level of abstraction, you see that overall, each layer seems sort of the unexpectedness of each convolutional layer modulates the brain response, but especially the highest convolutional layers. So if we now summarize over time and look at the effect of the level of abstraction in terms of their effect size, what we find is that indeed the later layers of AlexNet have the largest effect. And if you're a vision scientist, you may now be a bit puzzled, because this is indeed this is V1. So we see that the most abstract feature on predictability has the largest effect. We know from V1 that V1 itself is sensitive to low-level features. So indeed, if you do the classical sort of DiCarlo encoding approach, so we're not thinking about unpredictability now, but just the sensitivity to the visual features, we see exactly the opposite curve. So V1 neural responses are best predicted by low-level features, but high level unpredictability. So you see exactly the opposite tuning, which is kind of interesting. Oh yeah, and then sort of as a last tidbit, all this work, by the way, is still very much in progress. So it may still change a bit as we do some additional analyses. But one thing that I didn't want to ignore today is the laminar analysis. So in this data set, the mice have these neural pixels probes in their visual cortex, and they measure not just at one visual, at one cortical location, but they measure all throughout the cortex. So what you can do is look up for every unit that you record where they are in cortex, and then sort of very roughly subdivide them into superficial or deep cortical layers. And if you do that, you find that the effect is much stronger in the neurons that are classified as superficial than those in deep. But this is only for the feature unpredictability. We don't find this for contrast. So it seems that this unpredictability effect is not just tuned inversely to what you might expect from V1, but it's also strongest for the superficial layers compared to the deep, which is exactly in line with many of these theories about the predictive brain. All right. So if we come back to our question, so generalization, do we find that indeed the brain always predicts? So what these studies so far show, including others, is that in language, yes, in music, yes, in vision, yes, we find predictability effects and continuous prediction in all these domains. And if we then ask the second question, what is actually in this prediction? We see that in language, we find this hierarchy of predictions, where the brain is constantly predicting at multiple levels of abstraction, and higher levels seem to be able to inform lower level predictions. Whereas in music, we find strikingly low level in the sense of short range predictions. And then finally in vision, we find these higher level predictions that are then fed back to V1. Although I have to say that, yeah, this vision project is still work in progress, that the exact conclusions may still change. All right. So summing up, the rise of generative AI enables stronger and more precise tests of the predictive brain hypothesis. They so far reveal ubiquitous prediction in many domains and across levels of representation. And to me, at least, this really showcases the power of AI to change the way we do cognitive neuroscience. And yeah, well, the last point is just it's my own personal view, but I think this is really the future for the study of the predictive brain. So with that, I just wanted to thank you, of course, for your attention and all my co-authors, and especially the people who provided all the open source software and data, with a special mention here to Giovanni and the Lower Lab more generally, because without you, it wouldn't have been possible what I've been doing over the past years. So with that, thank you very much.
Well, cool talk. Really liked it. I'll. Anyone have any questions?
Should I stop sharing? Or?
No, you can. You can keep it up in case you have slides that could possibly answer questions.
That's true. Yeah.
So we have one for one of the attendees. We'll let attendees ask questions first, and then I have a question. Giovanni has a question. So if there's no questions, we'll ask some questions. But there's an attendee who has a question. Feel free to unmute if you'd like.
So I have a question about the language model.
Yeah.
So you talked about how, I know you used it as an example, but in the Old Man and the Sea example, it sort of used the context. I'm assuming, I don't know so much about the GPT models, but I'm assuming it uses context that it finds online to sort of make the predictions. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, definitely.
So would then understanding the human brain, like, wouldn't that be a big jump? Because the human brain doesn't have all of the information that, like, the model would have. So, like, context clues would be more in terms of, like, the meaning of the sentence. But then when you look at context clues that include all of the literature, ever written, wouldn't that be, like, a not equal comparison?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm really happy you asked this question because I first had a slide on sort of clarifications and common objections, but I removed it for the sake of time. But one of these things, it was actually really happy you asked, because it's a question that comes up a lot. So in this approach where you use a generative model to quantify the statistics that you hope that you assume that the brain is tracking, it doesn't require assuming that the exact statistics computed by GPT are exactly what is tracked by the brain. And what I often do is make a comparison to something like how we compute word frequency, for instance. So for word frequency, we often have these algorithms that that we count the word occurrences in a huge corpora, and they are often much larger than what you read in your entire lifetime. But so this is not meant to be an exact statistic of what you exactly have in mind. But what people tend to find is that the better you objectively approximate this statistic, on average, the better that you would track the specific predictions in the brain. And that's also what you find in language. So Marlies mentioned before that she couldn't really find significant effects, differences between different models like an RNN and an N-gram. But in reading time, in the reading time literature, people have done this a lot. And what people always find is that the better the language model becomes, so going from an N-gram via an RNN, via simple transformers up to like GPT, there's this monotonic, almost linear relationship between the quality of the language model and the quality of the fit. And that's probably not because the human brain is exactly making that prediction. Probably the human brain is doing something less sophisticated. It has also read less and learned less. But the more it matches the objective statistics, the more on average it will be closer to the idiosyncratic statistics of individual participants. So that was a long-winded explanation, but I hope it makes it clear.
Yeah, it makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mike. This is Ed Lawler here. I had a question on if I just trying to understand the you had a kind of an X shape for these predictions versus low level contrast that the V1 was sensitive to. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I'm maybe you could just talk us through that again, because I was trying to understand how what V1 might care about in terms of low level features.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I think about predictive coding theory, surely it should be getting predictions that are of predicted low level features. So
yeah,
my misunderstanding, maybe you could talk me through this curve again.
No, you didn't misunderstand it at all. And it is also surprising. And it's also what I expected, even though this particular neuron paper already pointed a bit in this direction. Mm-hmm. It was also what I expected. So I was expecting to find that early visual cortex is sensitive to predictability of low level features, whereas later visual cortex would be sensitive to the predictability of high level features.
Mm-hmm.
And that would indeed be in line with a very strict or sort of cartoonish view of predictive coding. But what we find is the opposite. So I think you understood it perfectly. We find this inverted tuning functions where, in terms of the low level features, V1 is indeed sensitive to the lowest levels of here you quantify it via the encoding performance of AlexNet. But in terms of the unpredictability, it's exactly the other way around.
Hmm.
And I can speculate why that may be. But in terms of if you've understood it correctly, I think you understood it perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, thanks.
Now, yeah, if there's not another question, I can also speculate a bit why this may be the case. One thing that I find myself especially interesting is that there are now results in machine learning where people are impressed by sort of the performance of GPT, for instance, and they think, okay, if we can learn everything there is about language just from predicting words, can we also learn everything there is to learn about vision just from predicting pixels? So they've trained these large models to predict pixels based on their occurrence. And what they find is actually that models that become really good at predicting pixels are really not so useful for high-level visual tasks. And the only methods that work really well in terms of this self-supervised pre-training are methods that explicitly, in some way or another, discourage the prediction of low-level features and encourage the prediction of high-level features. So what you see from machine learning is that the thing that's really useful in self-supervised pre-training is prediction of high-level features. And then what we see in the brain is that the thing that really drives early visual cortex is the predictability of high-level visual features. So that's, to me at least, a striking parallel. And to me, what that may suggest is that this may reflect a learning signal, which we know from machine learning to work really well. But that's, of course, speculation. You could also come up with other explanations, but it's my pet theory for why we may find this opposite tuning.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Thank you. Joe, did you want to ask a question or should I?
Yeah, I have a quick one, Aaron.
Go for it.
Music, hierarchy. Have you tried to look into, you know, your second point in the conclusions was that, yeah, there is the hierarchy in speech, but in music, you find this slow, small, you know, short context to be the optimal. But have you tried to combine short, long context?
No. The answer is no. I also really wouldn't know how you can do that, actually. This is why I like working with language so much, because we have this large inventory and we know that sort of words exist, at least if you believe words exist in the mind. And we have syllables and phonemes, and we can really dissect stimuli at these multiple levels and then explicitly look how one level informs the other. I wouldn't really know. So I know what a note is, but I don't have the conceptual apparatus to know what a word would be in music. So we could, I wasn't smart enough, let's put it like that, to perform the same types of analysis. But what do you think? How can you test this in music? What is the right level of granularity?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, from a purely methodological point of view, you could have multiple features fit with different context lengths. That's a boring thing. The other thing is inspired from what Ed said to me years ago on classical music, that the first time you listen to it, maybe you just focus on the on patterns that are short term, and then you start getting the you know, different levels of context. And so maybe modulating that on the participant, getting multiple repetitions of complex patterns and see whether that curve that you have there changes, you know, having the same identical method you have there but with different conditions or different
that's true. It would require, we wouldn't be able to use your download, your data, and use such an open-ended data set. But indeed, yeah, I agree. With sort of very clever experimental design, I think you can go there. And what did you mean with the first boring one? You meant like a decoding analysis and then sort of comparing the decoding performance on a time-resolved basis and relating that to expectedness or something? Or?
Sorry, Aaron, this is not as quick as I thought. I meant a bit like what you do in language, where you include multiple features, multiple surprise vectors that were fit using different context lengths. You know what I mean?
Right.
You could either simply use that model and have different context lengths.
If they're independent of each other.
Sorry? They could be both. Right. It just, maybe that's not, maybe not with that model, I don't know. Maybe the other models.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows? I don't know. I do like this effect, because initially Pius came up with the idea and I was like, are you sure, Pius? Because I think the better the model is, the better it will fit the brain. Do you think we can have an interesting effect? And then Pius likes to like, well, we don't know, blah, blah, blah. And then we did it and we found this really striking dissociation, and I never thought we would have. So,
cool. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marga. I think I will forgo my question. Might ask you offline for the sake of time.
I'll just say there was interesting suggestions in the chat, so thank you very much for that.
Yeah, I'll say that it was an interesting question. So anyway, so I'll let we should move on. Ola, I'll let you take over the screen share for the sake of time.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great.
Ola Bialis is a postdoc with Ed Lawler at the University of Rochester. He is a scientist after my own heart, I'd say. As a grad student, he helped write a toolbox for conducting auditory spatial experiments and analyzing auditory spatial data. And since joining the lab, one of his endeavors, along with one of our grad students, Jin Do, has been converting the MTRF toolbox into a Python library. And leading an unfortunate charge and converting the lab into a Python lab. His tutorial today will be full of simulations and interesting minutia. So I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I will. I'm looking forward to this talk from Ola, so I'll turn it over to him now.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron, for the nice introduction, and hello, everyone.
You're not sharing yet, by the way.
Yeah, I'm about to.
Hey, I'm on the screen twice.
Can you see my screen now?
Yep, all good.
All right. So I'm very happy that we already got to hear two really nice talks about all kinds of different aspects of speech and linguistics, because I don't want to talk about any of this in this talk. Instead, I just want to focus on the basic signal processing aspects of TRF models. But before I dive into that, the talk is called Fundamentals of TRF Analyses in Python. And so I want to take a moment to argue for why one should use Python. So for once, and most importantly, it's open source, meaning everyone can access it. It is one of, or even the most popular programming language. And to show that, I've included this graph here from a project called Popularity of Programming Language, which quantifies the share of different programming languages over time based on some Google statistics. And it's the data is on a log scale. So linear growth is actually exponential growth. And you can see Python is just on a ever steady rise, especially since 2015, 2016, triggered by the machine learning and AI boom. It's also easy to learn, which is in big parts because it is so popular, meaning there's just tons of materials online. And then finally, it's a general purpose programming language, which means that all things equal, it might be a better idea to learn Python than something domain specific such as MATLAB, because there's just a wider set of use cases for the language. And for those reasons, Jin and I wrote an implementation of the MTRF toolbox in Python called MTRFPy. We just recently published it in the Journal of Open Source Software. And so our objectives in making the software were that the API should be as similar as possible to the MTRF toolbox, so that people who already knew that would have an easy time using MTRFPy. However, we also wanted to use an object-oriented design because we felt that the code will just be easier to use if all the important methods and variables you would be interacting with are packed into one class rather than distributed across many functions. We use continuous integration, which means that we have a set of test scripts that runs automatically at any time we edit the code to check that everything is producing the results it should. And this is just generally a good practice in software design, but it's especially important in our case because, of course, we want to make sure that running the functions in MTRF toolbox and the corresponding functions in MTRFPy produces the same results if you run them with the same parameters. And we ensure that by using this continuous integration process. We wanted to keep it lightweight with minimal dependencies, so it right now only uses core Python functions and NumPy, which is the basic Python library for doing matrix computation. And this also helps us to make the code compatible with all kinds of existing pipelines. We, for example, did not introduce things such as custom data types because we want to avoid that people who want to use the code have to rewrite a bunch of their existing pipelines just to fit it in. And then finally, the software should be easy to use and learn, which is why we provide quite extensive online documentation and tutorials. So let me give you a quick overview of the code. The package consists of three modules. For once, the TRF class, which is the main class that the user is interacting with. There's also a module called stats, which features functions for cross-validation and permutation. And then there is a module called matrices, which contains functions to, for example, compute covariances and generate lag matrices and so on. Those functions are usually not accessed by the user directly, but rather called on by the other two modules. And then the TRF class takes a bunch of arguments, and those are kind of the meta parameters that define what kind of model you're using. So the direction, whether it's a forward or backward model, the method of regularization, or the metric that you're using to evaluate and compare different models. And then the important variables that you're usually interested in are contained in the attributes of the class, such as the weights of the TRF, the time lags, and the regularization coefficient. That's one point where we deviate from the MATLAB API. In Python, we can't call it Lambda because Lambda has already a defined function in Python, which definitely bothers me, but it is what it is. So we just have to call it regularization. And here's a little example of how to use it. I use this little function called load sample data, which downloads and returns about 2 minutes of EEG recording, along with a 16-band spectrogram of the speech the participant listened to. And I create an instance of the TRF class. So here using empty parentheses, meaning it's just going to use the default parameters, which will create a forward model with ridge regularization. And then use TRF.train, which is the equivalent of MTRF train, fitting the TRF to the stimulus and response. And then here I use the plot method to get just a quick visualization of this nice spectrotemporal response function here. We also use the opportunity to implement some functions that are not part of the original MTRF toolbox. For example, here I use this function called permutation distribution, which randomly scrambles the stimulus and response trials and then trains TRF models on this permuted data and returns a correlation coefficient and repeats this over and over again, here 1,000 times set by this parameter nPermute. And so you're getting 1,000 correlation values, and the distribution of these values, the permutation distribution, reflects the effect size that you're expecting in the absence of any actual causal relationship between stimulus and response. And then you can use this distribution to compare your actually observed correlation to and assess the significance of your result. So now I want to move to some demonstrations. In the tutorial, I'll be using actual brain recordings. Also, actually, the old man and the sea data. So that's just kind of the canonical data set for doing these kinds of analyses, apparently. But here I want to just use simulations, because the simulations are a really useful way of testing our intuitions and our understanding of these kinds of models. And all the code I'll be using from now on to generate the simulations and the plots, I've shared with the CNSP team. So I don't know if you already got it, but if you want it, you should be able to get it and play around with all of the parameters yourself. So I'm using a wavelet here to simulate neural responses. And a wavelet is generated by simply multiplying a sinusoid with a Gaussian. In time frequency analysis, we also use wavelets, rather complex wavelets, but here I only use a real valued one. And the neural response then is simulated by taking a stimulus, which is here just some square pulses that are randomly spaced and vary in their length. And then we convolve that stimulus with the wavelet, meaning we slide the wavelet over the stimulus and multiply it with the stimulus at every point. And then for each multiplication, we sum all the points and get 1 point of the response. So this basically means we're filtering the stimulus with the wavelet. And the result is our stimulated brain response, which looks like this. So whenever there's a pulse, you get like this thing here, which kind of looks like the wavelet or like a stretched version of the wavelet. And then if you have multiple pulses close to each other, the single responses kind of start to blend into each other. So if the distance between the pulses is less than the duration of the wavelet. And then we can use the TRF on the simulated response to see if we can recover this wavelet. So we're basically going to act as if the wavelet is not some approximation, but literally is how the brain responds to the stimulus. And then we're checking whether we can use the TRF to recover this ground truth from the data. And in this scenario I'm showing here, where there is no noise, there's just the stimulus and the wavelet, we can use ordinary least square regression, meaning we can set the regularization value to zero and just use TRF.train to fit the model, and then use TRF.predict to get a prediction of the simulated response. And on the left side, I'm showing the wavelet and the simulated response. And on the right side, I'm showing the TRF reconstruction and the TRF prediction. And you can see they're identical. So we're able to perfectly recover the wavelet in the absence of noise. But so now what happens if we start to introduce noise into the picture? So if we start adding normally distributed noise of increasing amplitude, then at some point this TRF is starting to break down. So here you can see at minus 30 dB SNR, it's really hard to still pick out the shape of the TRF from among the noise. And minus 30 dB isn't that noisy. So here in the bottom, you can see the noisy response. And even with the minus 30 dB, just by eye, you're still easily able to pick out the stimuli from among the noise, but the OLS regression is not. So we can circumvent that by starting to use regularization. So you can call the TRF.train function, and instead of using a single value for regularization, you can just pass a list of values. Here I use a log-spaced array. And then what will happen internally in the TRF function is that it will train a TRF for each value in this list and test them using cross-validation, and then select the value that gives the best model according to the metric you're using, which per default is Pearson's correlation between the predicted and the actual response. And then what you're seeing here on the right plot is the optimal value of the regularization coefficient lambda plotted against the signal to noise ratio. And you can see that the lower the SNR is, meaning the more noise there is, the higher the value of the optimal value of lambda. So the more noise, the more regularization. And with that regularization, we're able to recover the TRF even at much higher noise levels, like at minus 40 dB. And here in the bottom, you can see the noisy response to give you an idea what minus 40 dB looks like. So at minus 40, the response here, you can see the clean response in yellow, is really buried in noise, but still we can get back our TRF. Of course, it looks pretty spiky, and that is because we have a lot of high frequent noise in that signal. Usually in EEG, we filter out the high frequent signal, but here, since it's just plain white noise, there's a lot of high frequent power. One way to help with that is to use what we call Tikhonov regularization. So Tikhonov regularization penalizes the square difference between two neighboring weights in the TRF, meaning it kind of forces the neighboring points to take on similar values. And this usually leads to a smoother solution. So here, even at the minus 40 dB, we get a really good approximation of our original wavelet from the TRF. Other than that, it's the same thing in that the amount of regularization just kind of linearly increases on the log scale with lower SNR. But there is also a downside to the Tikhonov regularization, which is that if you use it in multivariate models, it can cause leakage between the features, which is something I'm going to come back to in a few slides. So far we've only used a single predictor, meaning we've used the univariate model. But of course, one really cool thing about these models is that they're able to incorporate multiple predictors and disentangle their relative contributions to the signal. So what I did here is I simulated the second stimulus, which is just a sinusoid, and added a second differently shaped wavelet. And then I convolved the green stimulus with the green wavelet and the yellow stimulus with the yellow wavelet. And I just sum the result of those two convolutions to get this stimulus here, which just looks like another sine wave with some spikes added on top. And then again, in this noise-free scenario, we can use the TRF with both stimulus features, and we can perfectly recover both of our wavelets, meaning the TRF is able to disentangle the two contributions, and the weights actually tell you how big the effect of each feature over time is on the signal. But so now, what if the stimulus features are confounded? So here I created what in causal analysis is known as a fork. So a fork happens when one variable Z causes both X and Y, and that makes it so that X and Y are correlated, but this correlation does not reflect any causal relationship. And in fact, the correlation disappears once you account for the common cause Z. So here Z is this sinusoid, and then the other stimulus X is generated by just setting it to one wherever Z exceeds a certain threshold, and it's zero otherwise, meaning the value of X completely depends on Z. And then the neural response Y here is created by convolving Z with a wavelet, meaning X does not affect the neural response. The neural response only depends on Z. And so now what happens if we train two TRF models to predict the neural response, one using stimulus feature Z and one using stimulus feature X? Well, if we use Z, we'll just get, again, our perfect reconstruction of the wavelet. This is just exactly the same scenario I showed in the beginning, if we just ignore X. However, if we only consider stimulus X, we'll still get a somewhat weirdly looking TRF, but that's definitely not random. And this is because X is actually correlated with the response. It does not reflect any causal relationship, but you're definitely able to predict the response based on X. So if you're just interested in prediction, it's totally fine to use X. Now, the interesting thing is that if we then use both Z and X in one common feature space, so here I create one stimulus by just stacking those two stimulus features Z and X into one matrix, and then use that to train the TRF, now we're able to disentangle the contributions. And this is what so now all the weights for X are zero. And this is what I mentioned in the beginning, that the correlation that's caused by the fork disappears once you account for the common cause Z. But so earlier I mentioned that Tikhonov regularization can result in leakage between the features. And now I want to show you what that means. So here, if we use Tikhonov regularization and we start using increasing amounts of regularization, so we increase the value of the regularization parameter from 0.001 up to 1, we can see that the more and more we're regularizing with Tikhonov, the more the TRF for X starts to approximate the TRF for Z. Whereas here with lambda equals 1, we might be tempted to think that they're both about equally important for generating the response, which of course is not true. We know this in this case because we simulated it that way. And this is the reason why it's usually not a good idea to use Tikhonov for multivariate models. Although this effect is not completely absent if you use ridge regularization. So you need to crank up the regularization much more with ridge to get non-zero values in X, but it is just technically possible. So I would argue that it's always a better idea to just not throw in every feature possible and let the model decide which features are important and which not, but rather a priori, based on theoretical considerations, decide which features are important. So here, the best possible scenario is if you can already a priori decide that X should not affect the neural response, and so you're just going to leave it out as a predictor. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention. Again, I would encourage you to check out the online documentation of the project, which contains tutorials on all the different aspects of TRF analyses. You can find it at the website called Read the Docs, or just via the project's GitHub. And also, if you're interested in contributing to this pretty new project, please get in touch. Both Jin, who you can see here in this picture, and I are very happy to receive any contributions. And that's it. Thank you again. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of you in the tutorial.
Cool. That was a lot of great minutia. Thanks, Ola. So if anyone has any questions, please feel free to ask. I'll hold my question until others have a chance to ask. But I didn't realize that you had a cat, Ola. It looks like...
It's not my cat. It's just some random cat in Greece on a holiday that walked like next to me.
Bummer. I thought it looked like Cosmo. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and ask my question. This is the first time I've actually ever seen the Tikhonov regularization demonstrating like that leakage, which thanks for that. I've always been like aware of it, like superficially, and always had like kind of thoughts. And I wonder if I could get your thoughts on it too. Is it possible, do you think, to implement a way in which Tikhonov doesn't leak across channels for other features? Is it in the way that the X design matrix is constructed, or is it just because there's something next door to it, it's going to like influence it?
I really don't have a good explanation of that. I think my understanding of linear algebra is insufficient to do that. But that's, by the way, one thing which I think is a great reason to use simulations. If you can't kind of decide it from first principles, a good idea is just to try it out in a scenario where you know the ground truth and see what happens. No, this is actually also just something I played around with to find out, but I don't have like a mathematically grounded answer for you. I'm sorry.
I just I was going to see if like Mick had any input. I just realized that Mick has been a participant this whole time and not a panelist. Sorry about that, Mick. But if you have any like thoughts on that, like I think Mick is going to be in your tutorial, so maybe you can say some words about that there, and we can figure that out, because I think that'd be an interesting thing to figure out. Any other questions? Well, there's a link. Giovanni put in the chat that I don't know if you knew this, Ola, but we've integrated your MTRF Pi into our web browser.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I think it's probably running completely on that, right, Joe? Yeah. It's all Python, unfortunately. Anyway, so for the sake of time, we'll cut it there. I will hang around in this Zoom room, and then some people will be in the tutorial Zoom room to answer any questions about setting up your environment for the two tutorials. So from here, we'll go to the tutorials. Everyone thank Ola for us. People are doing that in the chat. There'll be two links that were sent to you, and so you'll just choose one of those links to go to. And we'll meet there in about 15 minutes, okay? Thank you to all of the speakers and to all of the participants for interesting questions. We'll see you in a few. Dana has a question for me.
Hi.
Oh, sorry, I muted you.
It's okay. I wanted to ask if there's, I got lost a little bit in some of the emails. Is there new resources for the tutorials today, or are they the same resources that you sent in the email with the tutorial resources?
The first email I sent with tutorial resources were just for the ones yesterday. Yesterday I sent a link, or that email was sent about a week ago-ish, maybe a couple of days ago. But then I sent an email last night that has two links, and those two links are Colab notebooks, and each one of those notebooks is for one of the tutorials. And those should be the only resources you need. I think the data are contained in those links, at least for Marley's data, it's there. I think Ola's tutorial will download the data from OpenNeuro or somewhere that's just automatic. So if you're choosing Marley's tutorial, you might need to download some data to your own drive. If you're using Ola's, I think it'll probably be fine just to use that one link. Did you get that email?
The email that was the extension of the other, like it was a like a forward of the same email? Like it was a...
No.
It says track one, and then it has a Google Drive, and then track two, and then it has a Colab link. We're talking about that one.
The email starts, as you all know, there'll be two simultaneous tutorial tracks during day two of the CNSP workshop. I'm going to forward that to
copy
you
and
now.
Paste.
Actually, I'll just paste those two links in here. I'll forward that to you.
I can paste it on the Zoom I'm hosting, and then who's ever hosting the other room and just paste it there. You might have to copy and paste it a few times because once people join the Zoom, they won't be able to see the chat, I think, from prior.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't see an email. Besides the email about the mistake with the data that we got yesterday, I don't see another email from yesterday.
Oh, I see exactly what happened. I said, I wonder if I did not put any recipients in there and just sent it to us. I'll send that out again. Okay, thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you.
Aaron, I think it's just a link. I mean, send the email, but like in the chat of each track, we can share.
Yeah, you can put that in the next one.
Put it on the WhatsApp.
Straightforward to set it up, even Marley's one.
Cool.
And there is a raised hand among the attendees, by the way.
Go ahead.
Hi. I got a question about the BDF to CND script. When I try to run it, I receive an error saying unrecognized function or variable OpenBDF. So I noticed that this function is included in the readBDF function script, but I'm not sure how to fix it.
Is that in the libraries? Joe?
Yeah, it is on the documentation. So I suppose the BDF to CND is more of an example file.
Yeah, it wasn't anything for this tutorial or this year's tutorials at all.
But in I suppose the question is more in general. I mean, if you use BDF files, Jiayin, is that how you call it?
Yep.
If you have your own pipeline on how to load BDF files, you can use whatever script you generally use and replace that with the script. Otherwise, the library that should be included is EEG Lab. So the toolbox EEG Lab has some, I can't remember the name of the exact function now, which might have been from Filtrip originally, but generally I just use the scripts that are in there and then EEG Lab.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you already have a pipeline for BDF, for loading BDF files, you can just replace your functions on that. Have you worked with BDF in the past?
Yeah, I use EEG Lab, so I can just try to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, whatever functions you have been using in the past, just put them in there, and okay. once it's loaded, you can run everything else.
Yeah, and I also have a kind of related question. So I want to use MTRF to reanalyze the data previously designed in our N400 paradigm. So it means we got semantically congruent and incongruent sentence trails, and we got over 100 trails in total. My question is, for some participants, some trails were missing. I'm not sure if this will influence the conversion, because apparently some participants don't have all the data.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, the best thing to do, so in the CND, usually we have we have two options. One is to have one stimulus file for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, of course, every participant needs to have all the data. Mm-hmm. The other option is to have a stimulus file for each participant. So that's what you can do. You just build a copy of the stimulus file for each participant and just remove the trials that are missing.
Okay, thank you. That's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. And just one note on the BDF to CND, that is the trickiest part, because it's really dependent on your paradigm. So, you know, triggers,